Greetings, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society is an interdisciplinary group of Christian scholars devoted to the study of tradition, place, and things divine. To learn more about us, our events, this podcast, our journal, Pietas, and to sign up for our newsletter, please visit our website, ciceroniansociety.org. My name is Ethan Alexander Davey. I'm a professor of political science at Campbell University and a member of the board of directors of the Ciceronian Society. It has become our custom to begin all events and programs with a prayer. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Glory to thee, our God, glory to thee, O heavenly King, the Comforter, the Spirit of truth, who art everywhere, present, and fillest all things, treasury of blessings, and giver of life. Come and abide in us, and cleanse us from every impurity, and save our souls, O good one. Amen.
Amen.
Our guest today is Glenn Cronin. Dr. Cronin has a PhD in Russian studies from University of London. He's a contributing author to the edited volume Ideology in Russian Literature, published by Palgrave Macmillan in 1990. A few years ago, he retired from a career in the Department of Transportation in the United Kingdom and has once again taken up his pen. Our main subject today will be his book, Disenchanted Wanderer, The Apocalyptic Vision of Konstantin Leontief, published in 2021 by Cornell University Press. He has just completed another book about another Russian writer, Lev Tikhomirov, which is scheduled to be released in November 2025, also by Cornell University Press. And we're hoping to have him back on The Sower to talk about that book once it becomes available. Glenn, welcome.
Hello, Ethan. Nice to be here.
Very good. So today's program presents a special challenge. Our subject is the 19th century Russian writer, Konstantin Leontief. And Glenn has published a 200-page book about him. For my part, I published a couple of years ago a 40-page article about Leontief in an edited volume called Aristocratic Souls in Democratic Times. From this, it becomes obvious that both Glenn and I find this man's ideas very interesting, and we know a fair amount about him and could probably delve into all sorts of arcane questions if we wanted to. But I'm afraid we have to assume that 99% or maybe just 100% of our listeners have never even heard of Konstantin Nikolaevich Leontief. So that's where we need to begin. So could you tell us, Glenn, in broad strokes, who was Konstantin Leontief, and what are some reasons why 21st century people should bother to learn about him and even read his works, some of which are now available in English?
Thank you, Ethan. Well, Leontief was a very interesting character. It's been said many times that his life would make a good novel, actually. He was born in 1831 to a minor gentry family in Kaluga province, south of Moscow. He studied medicine at Moscow University and subsequently joined the Russian army during the Crimean War, where he had mixed fortunes. He was evidently quite a good surgeon and saved several lives through amputations, but he narrowly escaped being charged with desertion when he went absent without leave to visit his future wife in the Crimea. But he came through that, and then he gave up medicine, preferring to try and make a career as a writer and man of letters. Unfortunately, his strongly aesthetic views, his love of beauty above all else, which we'll probably talk about later, collided head-on with the strictly utilitarian approach to literature, which prevailed during the late 1850s under the aegis of such people as Chernyshevsky and Dobrolyubov. And it quickly was borne upon him that he wasn't going to get very far with literature at that time. So in order to earn a living, he joined the Russian diplomatic service and spent the next 10 years in various postings in European Turkey. This period had a strong influence on the formation of his later political views, which I guess we'll come to as well. But in 1871, the great crisis of his life appeared when he thought he was dying of cholera. He was in Salonika, in modern Thessaloniki, at the time as consul. And he made a vow to the Virgin Mary that if he recovered, he would go to nearby Mount Athos and become a monk. He did recover. It was malaria, in fact, and not cholera. And he did indeed go to Athos and spend 18 months there. But the elders of Athos rightly really decided he wasn't quite ready to take religious orders at that time. So he went back to Russia and subsequently began a career as a political writer. Again, he came to into collision with the predominantly racial Slavism, the Pan-Slavists at the time. We'll talk about that later. And eventually, he found employment as a journalist on a provincial newspaper in Warsaw, which gave him an opportunity to put forward his views. Unfortunately, his chronic bad health overtook him, and he retired to the monastery of Optina Pustyn, and later to Sergiev Posad near Moscow, where in 1891 he succumbed to pneumonia and died, and he's buried nearby. So that's a brief potted biography of the man. Why should we read him today? Well, I do remember from your article, Aristocratic Souls, which by the way, I thought was an excellent short version of his life in every way. But you did opine that his views, his political prescriptions would be unlikely to appeal to a modern Western audience, and I can understand that. I think if going back perhaps a decade or so before that, I would have agreed with you probably, and certainly going back to the 60s or 70s, I would have agreed with you definitely. But things have changed so much since then. Obviously, the Soviet Union has disappeared, and subsequently, we've seen such things as globalization, massive immigration to the West, and such things as the response to global warming, which seems to have driven a wedge between what you might call the liberal intelligentsia and large swathes of the population. To such an extent that the post-war consensus in Europe and the States, it seems to me, which was based around two large political parties in every country who generally speaking, believed in much the same things, and they tended to differ at the margins. And that seems to have dissolved itself rather now, and we're faced with a whole range of questions that we didn't have a few decades ago. I'm not suggesting for a moment that someone like Leontiev would have off-the-peg solutions to any of this, but I do think that a reflection on the responses that Leontiev and his contemporaries made to the crisis facing late imperial Russia will stimulate us to think about what the crises are that we are facing, and maybe it may inspire us with some solutions. I won't go on at great length about this, but I will just mention that the English political philosopher John Gray, who seems to take a very similar view, if I can quote from his book, The New Leviathans, he says parallels between late 19th and early 20th century Russia and the early 21st century West may seem far-fetched. Their histories are very different. Yet, says Gray, the similarities are real. Late Tsarism and the late liberal West produced an intelligentsia that attacked the society that nurtured them. Both are under attack from within. I think the implication behind Gray's hypothesis is that the political system in late imperial Russia found itself facing social and economic changes it couldn't cope with. And he thinks that the insights of people like Leontiev and Dostoevsky and others into the mindset of Russian terrorists and their intellectual fellow travellers, as he calls them, are acutely relevant to 21st century liberalism. So I guess the implication there is that both late Imperial Russia and the modern West are facing difficulties which they're having trouble coping with. In the Russian version, of course, it led to tragedy in 1917. And I guess Gray is worried about where we might be heading. So he thinks, and I agree with him, that a study of people like Leontief, while it won't bring us off-the-peg solutions to our problems, may stimulate us to think carefully about them and about the direction of travel. That's essentially my take on why he's important to us today. I also ought to mention, of course, that he's quite a good introduction to the Russian mind, which is, of course, an obsessive concern for everybody today with regard to Vladimir Putin. So that's another strand of Leontief's importance.
I just wanted to mention that I remember when I was reading your book and I saw the reference to my article, and I thought, I remembered that I was on the job market at that point, so I was being very careful. But I would agree with you that in the last a decade or so, his ideas have become more relevant and even imaginable as we see the changes that are going on in our politics and in our culture as well. All right. Since our listeners are hearing about Leontief for the first time, I thought it wouldn't be amiss to give them a little taste of his writing. So the first time I had heard of Leontief was when I was living in Russia and taking courses at St. Petersburg State University. I was signed up for a survey course on 19th century Russian philosophy. The professor was one Alexander Alexandrovich Yeremishov, who was also my academic supervisor. And he had obviously been lecturing to undergrads for many years. He started his lecture on Leontief with two stories that he thought were bound to grab their attention. And both of these stories are recounted in Glenn Cronin's book, but I'm going to refer to them in the order that I remember hearing them. So the first is an account of a conversation that Leontief had with a social democrat activist or nihilist, they gave him various names, Piotrowski, while they were taking a stroll in St. Petersburg in 1861. So here's that account, or part of the conversation that they had. Piotrowski had imagination, I felt. His eyes were so expressive and thoughtful, we often argued. Thus, we were walking one day along the Nevsky, and we were approaching the Anichkov Bridge. I asked him the following question, trying to phrase it as concretely as possible. Would you like to have a world in which all people everywhere live in identical, small, clean, comfortable little houses, the way people of middle income live in our Novorossiysky towns? Of course. What could be better than that? Piotrowski replied. Well, then, I am no longer your man, I retorted. If democratic movements must lead to such terrible prose, I shall lose the last vestige of my feeling for democracy. Henceforth, I shall be its enemy. Until now, I was not clear as to what the progressives and revolutionaries wanted. By this time, we were already on or near the Anichkov Bridge. On our left was the Belaserski mansion. It was of a rosy hue, with some kind of grayish or pale olive ornamentation, I remember, with large windows and huge caryatids. Beyond it, along the Fontanka Quay, could be seen the buildings of the Troitsky Conventual Church, painted dark brown and with a gold cupola on the church. While to the right, on the Fontanka, were a number of fish ponds with their yellow huts and fishermen in red shirts. I pointed out these fish ponds, the Belozersky mansion, and the church to Piotrowski, and I said to him this, "There is a living illustration for you. The church buildings are in the Byzantine style. That's the church, religion. The Belozersky mansion is in a kind of rococo. That's the aristocracy, the nobility. The yellow fish ponds and red shirts, that's the picturesque life of the common people. How beautiful and intelligent all this is. But according to you, it is necessary to destroy and level all this in order to have everywhere nothing but small, identical houses or those many-storied bourgeois barracks of which There are so many already on the Onyevsky Prospekt. How you love pictures, Piotrowski exclaimed. Pictures in real life, I protested, are not there for the pleasure of the spectator. They are the essential expression of some kind of inner, higher law of life, one that is as indestructible as all the other laws of nature. Such was our conversation. All right, so that's one example. And I was also going to talk about Leontief's conversion, but Glenn has already discussed that, right? So he was afraid that he was going to die, and he made this promise that that he would retire to a monastery, and that was his conversion moment, which, of course, as Glenn explains in the book, he struggled with throughout his life. But that's another very important moment in his life. Which is influential on everything that comes after. And there's one other passage I want to read. And this one, it's also cited in Glenn's book. This is one of Leontief's rants. He has excellent rants. And in this one, we can see a synthesis of his aesthetic ideals, which you've just heard about, and his Orthodox Christianity. So here's one of those rants. O hateful equality, O vile monotony, O accursed progress, O fecund and blood-stained but picturesque mountain of world history, since the end of the last century you are tortured by the pangs of a new birth, and from your suffering depths crawls out a mouse, a self-satisfied caricature of former men is born, an average, rational European, in his silly attire, indescribable even in the ideal mirror of art, with a mind shallow and self-deluded, creeping along the dust of the earth with his pragmatic good intentions. No, never yet in history before our time has anyone seen such a hideous combination of intellectual pride before God and moral humility before the ideal of a monotone, gray, proletarian, only proletarian, and godlessly passionless humanity. Is it possible to love such a humanity? Is it not right even for a Christian soul with all his strength to hate, not the men themselves, wayward and stupid, but such a future for them? It is right, three times it is right, for it is written, love thy neighbor and hate his sins. All right, so again, there's a lot there. We've got his aestheticism, we have his conversion to orthodoxy, and the synthesis of those ideas. So why don't we start with his aestheticism? Leontief argues that aesthetics ought to be the primary yardstick when it comes to art and literature, morality, and politics. And he maintained this view even after his conversion. So Glenn, your book examines all of this in great detail, and I particularly enjoyed the sections on his novels, which I have never read. But there's a great deal of interest there. So tell us some of his major arguments about aesthetics.
Well, Ethan, you've gone quite nicely into them already. I think the Piotrowski conversation really epitomizes Leontief's collision with the utilitarianism. And positivism, which really ruled in liberal circles in Russia and elsewhere at the time, is, yes, you're quite right. I mean, he considered aesthetics till the end of his life as being the best yardstick for history and for life, being applicable, he said, to all times and all places, and could accommodate everything, all religion and all morality. He wrote that to his friend Vasily Rosenov only 3 months before he died, well after his religious conversion. It's one of the things that makes Leontief a thorny character for many people, because he says what he believes in is the aesthetic of life, he says, which he said inevitably comprehended not just pleasure and joy, but pain and sorrow as well. And he felt that the pain and sorrow were a price worth paying in order to preserve the beauty of life. It's a difficult thing for many people to swallow. There's no doubt about that. But again, he does make us think whether the universal spread of democracy is not in fact reducing life to a quite a low level, actually. What he came up with, we'll come to that, I expect, as what he calls secondary simplification, where everything became much of a muchness. The idea that all colours mixed together become a uniform absence of colour, either white or black. I remember you said in your essay on Leontiev that he would embrace a civilization with a middle class, but not a middle class civilization. I think that's quite well put, actually. If I could quote something from him myself in this from one of his novels, actually, in 1862. What should we prefer, he says, the bloody but spiritually opulent age of the Renaissance, or something in the way of modern Denmark, Holland, or Switzerland, moderate, peaceful, and dull? Beauty, he says, that's the goal of life. And morality and self-sacrifice have value only as one of the offshoots of the beautiful, the freedom to choose what is good. I mean, statements like this have often led to him being compared with Friedrich Nietzsche, and I think there's quite a bit in that. I must admit, in my book, I rather tongue-in-cheek made a reference to the famous speech of Harry Lime in The Third Man, where he talks about the Swiss cuckoo clock as being the absolute nadir of culture. And I think there's something in that too. I mean, Leontiev went, as I said, to European Turkey, and he talked about the heartfelt relief he experienced on leaving the humdrum West behind and seeing crowds on the streets who were like a theatre come to life. And how relieved he was that there are places still in the world where life resembles an opera or a graceful ballet. What joy I felt, he says, to see these things. Now, it's a difficult pill for people to swallow, but on the other hand, it's a very, very stimulating. And I think that's how Leontiev should be taken, actually, not always perhaps literally, but as a stimulus to reflect upon whether, you know, our direction of travel is in every way the right one. He's a corrective, I think, more than anything else. As for orthodoxy, I think Leontiev's asceticism was also a struggle he had all his life within his own mind, his psyche, to reconcile his own determination to live an aesthetic life with the inevitable pangs of conscience which that produced, there were issues where he disregarded his mother's wishes for his future, and he loved his mother very much. He was serially unfaithful to his wife, who he also loved, actually, as became clear in his later life. He even had ambiguous relations, I have to say, with his favourite niece, which caused him a lot of problems. I mean, his friend Rozanov called him a half-angel and half-devil. He was, by bourgeois standards, amoral. There's no doubt about that. He was bisexual and made little attempt to conceal it at a time when it was not socially acceptable. And I think he saw an aesthetic worldview as a rationale for behaviour which even he, I think, found at times difficult to justify. And again, going back to the book that I quoted from earlier, he was asked, or his character was asked, if aesthetics would even justify violence. And the character replies, "We'll justify it with beauty. That's the only reliable yardstick. Every struggle," he said, "involves dangers, hardships, but man's higher than other creatures because he finds pleasure in the struggle, in overcoming them." Of course, as we've touched on, this aesthetic worldview could not survive the crisis in Salonika intact. And this led to his search to become a monk, which is something I think we may come to.
Yeah, so on that, you've begun to talk about how orthodoxy changed some of his views or modified some of his views. But yeah, maybe could you comment a bit more on, especially on how Orthodoxy and especially Orthodox monasticism influenced his thought? And along the way, perhaps define for us one of the key terms that he uses to describe the cultural influence of Orthodoxy, which is, let's see, in Russian, it's Byzantism. In English, it's a mouthful, Byzantinism. But yeah, if you could tell us a little bit about that as well.
Yes, well, he defined Byzantinism as literally a civilization possessing distinguishing features. And he described them as autocratic government, the Orthodox faith, and above all, a pessimistic morality, which was based upon a rejection of what he called the exaggerated individualism of modern society and the hope of creating a paradise on this earth rather than in the world to come. Of course, he was a confirmed skeptic with regard to human progress and the perfectibility of society on this earth. And he saw Orthodox worldview as challenging that. The period of Byzantine culture properly defined as lasting from Constantine the Great, who reigned from 306 AD, to Charlemagne in the 9th century. The 8th and 9th centuries. After Charlemagne, he saw that the West developed its own civilization and its own cultural flowering, and the Byzantine state was eventually eclipsed where it was in Constantinople. But of course, it was inherited by Muscovy following the conversion of Vladimir the Great in 988, and it became the, in Leontief's eyes anyway, the ruling philosophy which underpinned the state, Kievan Rus, and subsequently the Muscovy state. I think what Leontief found in Orthodoxy, and in particularly in monasticism, was a crutch, basically. After his near-death experience and his personal experience of the difficulty which is presented to a person with an aesthetic outlook by the great imminence of death and the apparent end of everything, he sought something which would endure beyond death. And he found that in Christ's precept that this kingdom, my kingdom, is not of this world. And I think the near-death experience inspired in him too a feeling that the essence of religiosity lay in dread. And he thought dread of sin and dread of death would inspire a religious feeling, which would issue in the end in love. He thought religion did not begin with love, it ended with love. It began with dread and ended with love. And he saw the monks of Athos and later of Optina, ascetic heroes, as he called them, or voluntary martyrs, as the absolute ideal of a Christian life, one that he, I must say, had great difficulty in meeting. And I think his friend Rozanov actually summed it up towards the end of his life. He said that Leontief remained an aesthete and a pagan in every fibre of his being, but he was desperately trying to be a Christian and to find salvation. I suppose this is where Rozanov got the idea of half devil, half angel from. So that's something of my view of his religiousness.
Right, yeah, right. That's an interesting question. Of course, there are much larger implications for Christianity, for civilization. But in the book, you mentioned that a good place to start to understand his views on Orthodoxy is the reminiscences he wrote about Father Clement. And so I had not read that before. I went and read most of it before this conversation, and. And unfortunately, I don't think that exists in any language other than Russian. But that would be It'd be nice if someone would translate that. But that one thing that struck me about that text, of course, he struggles with Christian asceticism himself. But in one of his other pieces, he says that, and in that piece as well, he says that this monasticism, of course, is something that only a tiny minority would embrace among Christians. But the example of that extreme asceticism can inspire in others something intermediate between that heroic asceticism, as he calls it, and those of us who are just caught up with our daily cares. And so I don't know, maybe he was maybe he achieved to some extent that intermediate position between the strict monasticism that he experienced and of course his aestheticism on the other side. So yeah, so let's carry on here. So Leontief, among other Russians at his time, such as Nikolai Danilevsky, whom you discuss a great deal, formulated a theory of civilizational development. And this theory anticipates many of the arguments of, for instance, Oswald Spengler in The Decline of the West, published almost half a century later. So could you tell us about his theory of civilizational development, in particular his triune theory of development?
Well, the 19th century, of course, was the great age of Darwinism, and the development of organisms from seeds through flowering to death. I think Leontief's theory is more a metaphor, really, than a thoroughgoing scientific theory. Danilevsky's theory, which preceded him by not very much, actually, is much more better researched and less amenable to reading, I must say. Leontief's book is a much better read. It's much shorter. and as you demonstrated earlier, he certainly has a way with words. But basically, their theories are very similar, that in nature, the original simplicity of a seed or a baby develops into flowering complexity of the adult plant, which flowers and so forth, and humans who become very differentiated individuals as adults. And then eventually both of these things die. The plant dies and the human being ages and dies, and they return to the original soil. So he said that societies too follow this process, that they are simple at the beginning, a tribe, for example, and as the tribe develops, becomes more complex, it differentiates into various different trades and classes, castes. This leads to a great flowering of culture within the society. But eventually, this flowering is exhausted and reduces into a kind of uniformity. And eventually the society dies. This was his thesis, that all societies go through this. He saw Europe of his day as having flourished during the Renaissance, but after the Enlightenment, gradually reducing, in fact, in the 19th century, at an ever-increasing pace, reducing into uniformity. And he thought it was on the road to disappearance, actually. He didn't think Russia was quite there yet, but he thought it would follow the same pattern. Now, I mean, one can take this with a pinch of salt. I mean, today this kind of historicism, this rather crude historicism, is unfashionable and for good reasons. But as a metaphor, though, I think it certainly has something going for it. And if one wants to get into this, I think Leontief's Byzantinism and Slavdom is a much better way in than Danilevsky's Russia and Europe, which is five times longer and much more difficult to read. So yes, that's I'll just sort to mention that the very cornerstone of this for Leontief was the notion of diversity and unity. That diversity in unity, that in order to achieve flowering complexity, the society had to be informed by a central idea, and that would cause the flowering to be related and not chaotic, as he put it. Yeah.
My favorite version of the metaphor, I think that's a good way to put it too, and it's quoted in the book. He compares the development of civilizations to apples, right? And so in the first stage, he says all apples are green and sour; they're all alike. And then in the stage of flowering complexity, there's a great multiplicity of different colors and flavors and different textures and so on. And then when you get to the third stage, they're all alike. All the apples are alike. They're all brown mush, basically. And that third stage, of course, is democracy. It's liberal democracy. So there's and so he's it's quite interesting that the way he draws these parallels.
That's right. I mean that if I'm just interject quickly, the middle stage of flowering complexity was all important to Leontief. It's what made life worth living. And his determination to preserve this as far as possible is what led him into making statements that might seem a little extreme in some respects, especially to the modern tastes. But it was this stage of complexity with everything it produced. The European Renaissance was his absolute example of this. He was just keen to preserve this. Yes.
So it's clear that Leontief was a nationalist of a kind, and as we've just been saying, the most important political goal for him was to preserve a distinctive culture, a culture of flowering complexity, to use his term, and to preserve the culture of his nation first, but ultimately of all nations. I think he was concerned with preserving that diversity globally as well. So this meant preserving the distinctive elements of each national culture, such as their religious doctrines and practices, the regional geographical variations in culture as well. So he's a kind of nationalism, but at the same nationalist. But at the same time, he makes a perhaps surprising argument against ethnic or racial nationalism. So why was he opposed to ethnic nationalism?
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is what brought him into his second great crisis, actually, in 1874, because he came back from the East believing that he was absolutely on the same page as the Slavophiles in Russia, but he wasn't. Basically, he came into sharp conflict with the Pan-Slavists, particularly in the person of Ivan Aksakov. The reason for this, I think, was that what he'd seen in European Turkey was that the Southern Slavs, as they were called, what we would call the Serbs, the Bulgars, Montenegrins, and so forth, which were being courted by the Slavophiles, he saw them as being a long way down the road to being completely taken over by Western democratic values. And he thought that if the Russian Slavophiles got too close to them, that they would, in his terms, get infected from them with Western values. What Leontief saw was that it needed something greater than mere racial similarity or affinity in order to keep culture together. And he saw it. He found this in orthodoxy. He thought that it shouldn't be pan-Slavism in a racial sense. It should be pan-orthodoxy. And then that would be the unifying idea which could underlie the flowering of a Slavonic, basically Slavonic culture in Russia and in the Slav countries. Because of this, he found the Greeks, especially the Constantinople hierarchy, which a lot of the Greeks didn't like very much, as far preferable to the rather Europeanized democratic Bulgarians and Serbians. I mean, he believed that the older Slavophiles like Khomyakov and Kireevsky would have preferred, he said, cultural assimilation with the peoples of Asia, Turks, Tibetans, or Hindus, rather than a political federation with the southern and western Slavs. Of course, for someone like Aksakov and the Pan-Slavists, this was absolute anathema, and they did anathematize Leontiev, and he basically fled Moscow after that. As I said earlier, he went to Warsaw in the end. But I do believe that this notion of pan-orthodoxy rather than racial Slavism was Leontiev's unique contribution to the debate. And I think it's what makes him stand out as a really unique and original thinker of the time. Although, of course, he was, you know, a prophet in his own country and got no kudos from that. But in our eyes today, I think it is quite an original idea, and I think it does make him stand out as quite an original thinker. Yes.
So Leontief was also quite critical of the moral and political teachings of the most famous Russian novelists of his time, Dostoevsky and Tolstoy, and as you note in the book, he accused them of promoting a rose-tinted or sentimental version of Christianity. Maybe we could use the term from the 1950s and say a pinko Christianity or something like this. So what did he mean by that?
Well, you quoted earlier some of Leontiev's, as you put it, ranting, and he certainly did rant at times. There was nobody in his entire life who came in for more invective from Leontiev than Leo Tolstoy. I can't remember all the things he called him, something like an old maniac, someone who's destroying the pieties of the common folk. Dostoevsky was kinder too, but the problem with both of them, from his point of view, from Leontiev's point of view, was that they rooted their religious feelings in love. And to Leontiev, this made religion more akin to social work, really, than true religion. Leontiev insisted that the relationship of man to God should be rooted in dread. He said dread of hell in the life to come and dread of death and what will happen after death. But he said that dread would give birth to love, if it was allowed to work. He developed a term which he called transcendental egoism, which it was a kind of way of squaring the circle, because he certainly was a very egotistic person, and his aestheticism was of that kind. But he found if you could transfer this egoism, your desire for your own salvation, into the transcendental realm, the life to come, he thought, and there's something in it, that it would be a greater stimulus or more reliable stimulus to moral, an ethical action, actually, than love, which he found to be too abstract and wishy-washy a theme. He once said that he was, in regard to Dostoevsky, he wasn't altogether on the side of the Grand Inquisitor, but he had nothing. He couldn't have anything to do with what he called the all-forgiving anodyne Christ that Dostoevsky had dreamt up for himself. And yes, he had no time for what you've just called pinko Christianity, I'm afraid. And although he never, we have to admit, he never really reconciled his asceticism with his religious dread, as Rosenow very acutely realized. But he tried.
So on this same point, other Russian authors were also critical of Leontief's interpretation of Christianity, and of course discussed this in the book as well. Some of them accuse him of being more of a pagan or more of a Muslim than a Christian. Right, you've said there's something to these claims. Maybe you just tell us a little bit more about that.
Yes, I think the biggest problem that some of his contemporaries had with him was that they felt that he aspired to a dualism in religion of the Manichaean version, because he separated this world and the next, and this goes back to his criticisms of Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. He drew such a distinct line between works in this world, Christian works, as it were, and dread leading to fixation on the life to come, that they felt he was coming very close to the idea of Zoroaster. There are two principles at work here, the light and the dark, the good and the evil, and that he was drifting away from the Christian sense that, you know, evil is a rejection of God's goodness. And there's something in this. I mean, certainly Vladimir Solovyov felt that, Berdyaev, Rosenow, of course, they thought he'd never escaped from this religious dualism. And I think there certainly is something in that. But Leontiev himself considered that Christianity contained within itself everything that was strong and good in other religions. And certainly, I mean, his fatalism and longing for submission has got something obviously Islamic about it. How far he acquired this during his time in the East, it's difficult to say, but he certainly had an aesthetic admiration for Islam, which comes out in his approval. There's one very poetic passage where he has a character in one of his novels listening to the muezzin calling to prayer in the dark, and he said what a beautiful feeling that gave him. Buddhism as well is there. Towards the end of his life, he many times evinced a desire for nothingness, basically to just have a complete annihilation of his self. And certainly that recalls the Buddhist search for nirvana. There's a quote I've got here. A soundless, passionless, mute obliviousness among eternal snows is what he was aspiring towards. It's quite interesting that in later life he became quite a devotee of the German philosopher Schopenhauer, who is of course known as the philosopher of pessimism, and an opponent of progressive liberal ideology in the utilitarian sense. So yes, there was a lot of it, of different strands to Leontief's religion. He once said, if people can't be good Orthodox Christians, it's better they should be good Muslims or Buddhists, sectarians, anything, he said, rather than westernized liberals. So eclectic, but interesting.
That's right. The worst thing one could be would be a secular liberal. Anything would be better than that.
Really. Yes.
So your book is obviously much better researched than my little article on Leontief. And I don't doubt that his understanding of other religions influenced his thought. But one thing that struck me is that one of his core ideas sounds just like what St. Augustine wrote in City of God. And we've only talked about this a little bit so far, but for Leontief, beauty in history is created by contrasts, by the collision of these different contrasts and under a kind of spiritual unity. So there's this passage I'd like to read from St. Augustine's City of God, which to me kind of sums up Leontief's view of history. So he says, this is City of God, Book 11, Chapter 18. And the heading is, "The beauty of the universe made richer by God's providence through the opposition of contraries." So St. Augustine says, "For God would never have created a man, let alone an angel, in the foreknowledge of his future evil state, if he had not known at the same time how he would put such creatures to good use, and thus enrich the course of world history by the kind of antithesis which gives beauty to a poem. Antithesis provides the most attractive figures in literary composition. The Latin equivalent is opposition, or more accurately, contraposition. And the Apostle Paul makes elegant use of antithesis in developing a passage in the second epistle to the Corinthians. By means of the arms of righteousness on right hand and left, through glory and ignominy, through infamy and high renown, as deceivers and yet truthful, as unknown and well known, as dying, and here we are alive, as punished and yet not put to death, as full of grief but always joyful, as in poverty and yet enriching many others, as having nothing while possessing everything. The opposition of such contraries gives an added beauty to speech, and in the same way there is beauty in the composition of the world's history arising from the antithesis of contraries, a kind of eloquence in events instead of in words." So again, all of this sounds very much like what Leontief himself said. So I wonder if maybe the Augustine is perhaps one of the key sources of some of his core ideas about history and morality and aesthetics and so on.
Yeah, you've got me there a bit, because I don't think Leontief had read Augustine. Now, I may be wrong, because it's going back a bit now. But the similarity is, as you say, striking. In his early novels, Podlipki was his first long novel. He ended by saying that a certain amount of evil is necessary in the world to, as he put it, add salt to the good. And if I could just read you a quick quote from his second long novel, The Svojom Kraju, in a place of his own or some such. He says, he has his main character telling a dinner party, I think. "So don't, for God's sake, be afraid of evil," he says. "Don't you see, evil, given its head, will generate good? If for the existence of Cordelia at one pole, a Lady Macbeth is necessary at the other, then let's have her. But preserve us from debility, slumber, indifference, turpitude, and mercantile caution." Now, there is a remarkable similarity in views here. And I did revisit Augustine before this and noted that he early came under the influence of Mani and Manichaeism, though he later rejected it. Absolutely. And that's certainly, there's a symmetry between Leontief and Augustine, undeniably, even down to the fact that both were influenced by an elder, Ambrose of Milan in Augustine's case, and Ambrose of Optina Pustini in Leontief's. So it's a fascinating thing whether this, as I say, I can't quite recall whether and how far Leontief may have read into Augustine, but certainly if he didn't, it's a remarkable example of what you might call convergent evolution, that two people went through the same process and came out with the same ideas at the end. Yes, it's a fascinating angle on the whole thing. Thank you.
Right, yeah, convergent evolution, that's certainly possible. I think he does cite St. Augustine and cites the City of God. I'm not sure that he cites that particular passage, but at least he was familiar with some of it.
I'll go back into that. Yes, thank you.
All right, so we've covered a lot of ground, and of course there's a great deal more to know about Konstantin Leontief, his place in 19th century European thought, and the implications of his ideas for later generations and for the present. So I strongly recommend that our listeners get a copy of A Disenchanted Wanderer, which for an academic book is actually quite reasonably priced, I was pleased to see, unlike my academic books, which are highway robbery. So please get a copy of the book. The last thing I'd like to do is ask Glenn to give us a very brief preview of his next book. So tell us the title of your new book, and I'll ask you the same basic question, since, again, I doubt anyone outside of Russia has ever heard of Lev Tikhomirov either. So in broad strokes, who was Lev Tikhomirov, and what are some reasons why 21st century people should learn about him?
Well, thanks for giving me the chance to give a plug to the new book. One reason why they should do that, of course, is that they should buy the book, which is always a good reason. But seriously, it comes out in November, again from Cornell, under the title The Enduring Enigma of Lev Tikhomirov. And the enigma stems from the fact that he, like Leontiev in a way, had been through a life crisis in his late 30s. He was a fascinating character in a way because during the 1870s, he was very prominent in the Russian revolutionary movement. He was actually the chief theorist of the People's Will group, which assassinated Tsar Alexander II in 1881. After that, though, he fled abroad for 7 years and carried on initially doing revolutionary theorizing. But he seems to have had a road to Damascus experience himself. And in 1887, he petitioned the new Tsar, Alexander III, the son of the assassinated Tsar, for permission to return to Russia. And it was granted. I think it was granted because the Russian authorities, the Okhrana, saw that turning a big fish like Tikhomirov would be a real feather in their cap, actually. But anyway, when he came back, he became an outspoken defender of autocratic monarchy and the Orthodox faith. And what motivated this Damascene conversion has been the subject of controversy ever since, and the book is my contribution to this debate. He wrote some very interesting articles after this, well, books actually, long books on the nature of monarchy and political power, and on comparative theology, which are of considerable relevance outside of Russia in our modern world. He's not well known in the West because basically he became a non-person after the revolution, and his books were actually burned, although copies survived, obviously. There's a great interest now in him in Russia post-Perestroika, but it so far hasn't filtered through much to the West. And my book will actually be the first full-scale study of the man in English. So I think it'll be a very interesting read and also thought-provoking for the reasons we went through earlier, and I won't go through them again now, as to why such people as Leontiev, Tikhomirov, Dostoevsky are so relevant to the problems we face in the West today and can give interesting and thought-provoking insights into the political situation we found ourselves in today. And I think that's probably the best reason for reading them now, actually, is that they do help us understand the predicaments we face today.
And if the Soviet authorities burned his books, probably Tikhomirov was onto something, we can guess, right? But yes, I very much look forward to reading that book and to talking to you again, perhaps in a few months when that book is out. So Glenn Cronin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, Ethan. Nice to see you.
You've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you've enjoyed this conversation, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. If you haven't heard yet, we'll be having our 2026 conference at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, March 12th through 14th. Paper and panel proposals are due September 1st, and we hope you'll consider joining us for what is always a great time. Be sure to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website, ciceroniansociety.org. Thank you for listening.